Welcome to the ABR podcast, where some of Australian Book Review's contributors read their articles or discuss them with ABR staff. My name's Georgina Arnott and I'm the assistant editor at ABR. If you enjoy these podcasts, think about subscribing to the magazine. Those 25 and under can do so for as little as $25 for the online version or $60 for print plus online.
Available in July is Swimming in Words, new and selected poems by Luke Icarus Simon. Simon's poems propel you into their sensual, visceral world, always redolent of passion. Luke Icarus Simon has been widely published in journals and anthologies since the 1980s. This is his fourth poetry collection. He writes from the perspective of an immigrant gay man documenting his lived experience. Swimming in Words comprises 70 poems, including the eponymous 4,000-word prose poem.
In this week's ABR podcast, Peter Rose reviews Hazard and Harrower, The Letters, edited by Brigitte Aloubis and Susan Windham. The correspondence between writers Shirley Hazard and Elizabeth Harrower ran from 1966 to 2008, and in its unedited form amounted to about 400,000 words. Editors Aloubis and Windham have trimmed it down. For the time being, writes Peter Rose in his review, we must make do with this entertaining and not insubstantial entree. All letters withhold and dissemble, he goes on to say. En masse, Hazard and Harrower's do so less than we might have expected, and yet paper always provides a kind of shelter. Rose writes, as Cicero reminds us, a letter does not blush. Among other works, co-editor Brigitte Aloubis is the author of Shirley Hazard, A Writing Life. ABR editor Peter Rose interviewed Aloubis about the book for the ABR podcast in March 2023, and you can catch up with the episode if you missed it by returning to our podcast homepage. For now, here is Peter Rose with Flies in the Nirvana, an illuminating and sisterly correspondence, published in the June issue of ABR.
Everyone allows that the talent of writing agreeable letters is peculiarly female. So said Jane Austen in Northanger Abbey. Even allowing for Regency hyperbole, there is some truth in the sally. We think of the inimitable letters of Emily Dickinson. In 2001, Gregory Kratzmann edited A Steady Stream of Correspondence, Selected Letters of Gwen Harwood, 1943-95. Anyone who ever received a letter or postcard from Harwood, surely Australia's finest letter writer, knows what an event that was. She was simply nonpareil, witty, astringent, frank, irrepressible. Now we have this welcome collection of letters written by Elizabeth Harrower and Shirley Hazard, unalphabetized on the cover, in a possible concession to the expatriate Hazard's greater international fame. Hazard and Harrower, as the book is titled, is unusual in a few respects, not just because of its span from 1966, when Hazard wrote to Elizabeth, if I may call you that, until Christmas 2008, when Harrower sent S this card, A Light in the Darkness. This was shortly before dementia started to eclipse Hazard. Few published literary correspondences last so long or tell so much, lightly, warmly, absorbingly. All letters withhold and dissemble to some degree, but these ones are surprisingly open, and mostly generous and encouraging. Surprisingly so, perhaps, for two major writers, one of whom, already prominently married and situated at the outset, became internationally famous in her late 40s, while the other, strikingly successful in the 1960s, retired hurt from the field and became almost anonymous until Michael Haywood of Text Publications reprinted her novels, restored her reputation, and persuaded her to publish a late novel. All this well after the span of this book and the sending of that light in the darkness. The editors, Sydney journalist author Susan Wyndham and Hazzard's biographer Brigitte Aloubis, a professor of English at the University of New South Wales, have turned 400,000 words of correspondence into, quote, a more acceptable book length. In a country with a more resilient biographical and epistolary tradition, we might have expected the entire correspondence, given the stature of these two writers. For the time being, we must make do with this entertaining and not insubstantial entree. It was Hazzard's mercurial mother, known as Kit, who brought the two women together. Already by 1966, Harrower in Sydney was a kind of companion or carer to Kit, quote, charming, lonely, and mentally fragile, as the editors write in their introduction. It would become a kind of lifelong responsibility, curse even, one that Harrower's friend Patrick White considered a major factor in her lengthening creative silence. Writing to Harrower in 1971, White said, "We were alarmed to hear that Mrs. Hazzard has broken a leg and was returning to Australia. Keep well away, or you'll be landed with her forever." White was a great admirer of Harrower, especially her fourth novel, The Watchtower, published in 1966. Harrower's greatest achievement and one of the greatest Australian novels, according to the editors. Characteristically, White withdrew his own masterpiece of that same year, The Solid Mandala, so that his friend could win the Miles Franklin Award. She didn't. In the end, White gave up trying to persuade Harrower to write, quote, "Too many vampires make too many demands on her." Hazzard's conduct during the decades of Kit's dependency on Harrower, which amounted to near servitude for the Sydney writer, seems dubious and exploitative. Hazzard is a skillful, courtly tactician. In 1973, she writes, "Elizabeth, you have done so much and one blushes to ask further. Could you possibly hand in the application and ask whether questions might be relayed or answered by you? I would send the application to you. It would need my mother's answers on a few dates." At times, the reader wonders why the moneyed Hazzard and her husband, Francis Stigmuller, who divided their time between Manhattan and Italy, didn't simply buy an air ticket and fly to Sydney to alleviate the pressure, especially in 1980, when Harrower was once again left to mop up. Hazzard again, "That you should have undertaken the monstrous task of closing up MM's flat, my mother's flat, has been a sort of last straw of ultimate largeness of heart," Hazzard wrote with a kind of polished contrition. We know from Aloubis' admirable biography, Shirley Hazzard, A Writing Life, published by Virago in 2022, that Hazzard's filial relations were disastrous from the start. When Shirley was 6 or 7, Kit asked her to join her in putting their heads into a gas oven so that they could die together. Kit was the most capricious and ungrateful of mothers. The two writers were mystified by the turmoil of Kit's domestic arrangements, and her emotional instability is a constant in the book, and mostly a unifying one. Kit was incurably peripatetic, fleeing Sydney, hating London, despising the Stigmullers' Tony life in Manhattan, then bolting back to Sydney and starting all over again. For Hazzard, who rarely spoke of her mother with any fondness, Kit was, quote, "pretty close to unhinged a lot of the time. It is amazing how much horror, and strenuous horror at that, this little being managed to generate. Knowing her makes for a weird, inimitable bond, like having been together in a shipwreck, unquote. Well into the friendship, Hazard wrote, quote, "You are utterly marvellous as ever to take MM for birthday lunch. I am sometimes desperate about her state." As Cicero reminds us, a letter does not blush. Only rarely and circumspectly does Harrower presume to give her friend advice. In 1973, when Kit was being impossible and suicidal again, Harrower risked, quote, "If you can give your mother something to look forward to, some idea that she'll see you again, this will be what will settle her and calm her, I think." Unquote. How cautious and forbearing is that, I think. Still, Harrower understood better than most the impossible side of YM, your mother. Quote, "She can be exceptionally winning and she can be merciless. They say that every difficult soul affects the lives of 14 others." Unquote. Along the way, there are wonderful surprises and insights. Writing about a play by Carly Tennant, Hazard notes, quote, "I've always envied playwrights. Dialogue is what I like to write. I sort of wait for it to come along on the page." Makes you wonder why she didn't try drama. Christina Stead, a vivid, poignant presence in the letters, is quoted as telling Harrower, "Patrick and Manoli are your brothers." Hazard describes Francis's lifelong work on Flaubert, quote, "Also, MS pages of Madame Bovary, fascinating to see, incredibly overwritten with every change, seething with intense intention," unquote. Hazard declares that she wouldn't stay in Italy if the fascists, or for that matter communism, took over. Quote, "There is always a fly in the nirvana." About Muriel Spark, who had introduced her to Francis, Hazard is canny, quote, "What a clever little creature MS is when she can cut away all the rubbish. Good initials too, for a writer." Hazard is instinctively aphoristic, quote, "People think they want tranquility, but what they mostly want is for things to go wrong," unquote. Then she can be confidential, quote, "What has any self-respecting person ever been of recent centuries in their country but in exile? What has old Sherl ever been in all her life but an exile? What is any writer worthy of his salt but an exile?" Unquote. We forget what fine old lefties both women were. During Watergate, Hazard writes, it is utterly engrossing. The unveiling of Nixon's paranoia, his Führer complex, the power these people have had, and the Nazism they expound. Harrower provides an anguished record of the Whitlam government. Her long letters of the 17th and 30th of November 1975 contain some of the great reportage on the dismissal. Harrower happened to be in Canberra on Remembrance Day 1975, visiting Christina Stead. Quote, "Telephone rings. I hear Christina saying many times, 'But that's terrible, that's terrible.' Finally, she came in. 'What's happened?' I asked. 'Malcolm Fraser is Prime Minister. Kerr has got rid of Whitlam.' Horror, horror and stupefaction. People very nearly fell down in the street with amazement and dismay. Manning Clark, our most splendid historian, said he was literally sick. Switched on radio, which was dooming away in stunned voice. Christina offered gin, brandy, sherry, while I paced about holding head and listening to reports. Finally knocked off some Nescafe and took taxi to Parliament House. People surged there from everywhere. It was so awful. Everyone was outraged. Our votes meant nothing. Moderate reform is not allowed to take place here. The new leaders came out on the balcony and laughed like Nazis." Unquote. From Alubis's biography, we know what a cultivated and bookish life the Stigmullers led in New York, and Europe. Hazard's appetite for and retention of poetry, though none of it Australian, was formidable. She knew reams of it by heart, loved it, lived it in a way. Famously, on first meeting Graham Greene, she capped a Browning quote for him. In New York, the Stigmullers would think nothing of reading Thucydides or Dante or Tolstoy right through on their rare evenings alone. They were constant hosts. Few of these heroic bibliophilic feats infiltrate Hazard's letters. Shirl grows too fond and comfortable to feel the need to show off, as she often does elsewhere, however unconsciously. But the letters are full of authors and books and frequent clippings. It is fascinating to keep up with what they are reading, sharing, discovering. Judah Watton, Edmund Wilson, Elizabeth Hardwick, Frank Morehouse, Trendy Sex, on Harrower's part, Hal Porter, Edward Albee, Nadine Gordimer, even Thomas Pynchon and Arnold Bennett on Hazard's part. Endearingly, she, quote, cannot abide Woody Allen, nor get the point. Now and then she is acerbic. In 1980, when Frances Stigmuller's edition of the Flaubert letters appears, she writes of the reviews, quote, since they would not be reviewers if they really knew anything, and since it's all favourable, no complaints from me. Hazard is mordant about Murray Bale, who was then a trustee of the National Gallery of Australia. Quote, Murray not only has no eye for painting, his eyes are closed. The visual arts in Australia are, what, a busy desert, unquote. We find out why in the Alubis biography. A letter from Bale had led the Stigmullers to abandon their plan to bequeath their not inconsiderable art collection to the Art Gallery of New South Wales. In 1979, Patrick White read the galleys of Hazard's novel, The Transit of Venus, and was underwhelmed. Quote, you're inclined to strike attitudes and pirouette around yourself, but only here and there. Then he went on for the jugular. To me, you do lead an especially charmed life, writing away in the NY apartment and Capri villa while collecting your celebrities and charmers. Unquote. This was too much for Hazard. Writing to Harrower, she said, it is furthermore dispiriting to find a really great man like Patrick White writing the letter of any spiteful old queen. Unquote. It was easy, still is perhaps, to parody the Stigmullers' gilded existence, the, quote, lovely life that Kit Hazard liked to mock, despite her reliance on their generosity. The Transit of Venus, Hazard's magnum opus, came out in 1980 and survived White's monstering. It won Hazard the National Book Critics Circle Award and changed everything for her. Later, after Stigmuller's slow decline and eventual death in 1994, The Great Fire, published in 2003, her fourth and final novel, won Hazard the Miles Franklin Literary Award. Never, despite the laurels, the distance between them, the brave solo travels in her latter years, does Hazard stop encouraging Harrower or hoping for a new novel from her. It seems likely that she admired Harrower's writing more than Harrower admired hers, with the exception of the famous early short stories published in The New Yorker. There are hints now and then concerning the Stigmullers' formidable social orbit in New York. When the Isaiah Berlins come to town, the Stigmullers expect to dine with them in pursuance of lovely life, Hazard wryly notes. One New Year's Eve, they head to the Met. Quote, we were the guests at the opera in the box of the manager, who was a chum of ours. Joan Sutherland, in glorious voice, proceeded to sing a high camp and highly entertaining daughter of the regiment to thunderous applause. Then there is this classic from 1982, when the Stigmullers hoped that Harrower might stay with them in New York. Quote, "The only problem is that most of our pictures will be out of the house. We sometimes send them to the Metropolitan Museum Summer Loan Show, particularly if we're having a room painted or something of that kind." In the 1980s, there was a rupture in the friendship, doubtless traumatic for both women. For years, the Stigmullers had begged Harrower to visit them in Italy or New York as their guest. It is a kind of embarrassing refrain in their letters. In 1971, Frances Stigmuller, who often added fond postscripts to Shirley's letters, wrote, "We must meet. It seems almost weird that we actually haven't met." Hazard was equally importunate, ending one letter, quote, "More soon, dearest Elizabeth, and tremendous good wishes from us all, an utter determination on the Stig's part to arrange a reunion in 73. Unquote. More intuitive hosts might have got the message and desisted, but not the Stigs. In 1984, Harrower, not an inveterate traveller and wary about money, finally succumbed and met them in Rome. Harrower was tetchy from the start, complaining that a room at the Hassler Hotel, where the Stigmullers always stayed in Rome, did not have a view, and resenting Hazard's touristic bossiness. "There you go again, I don't accept orders," said Harrower. She stayed with them on Capri, then decamped, skipping New York and returning to Sydney. We know all this from Hazard's diary, not from the correspondence. Henry James wrote of the letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, "One has the vague sense of omissions and truncations. One smells the thing unprinted." The women hardly referred to the Roman debacle, and yet, rather movingly, a new kind of rapport entered the friendship. Interestingly, the editors write, "From this coolness, this shifting of tone and focus, a new warmth develops, at least within the scope of the letters, which provide a less fraught account of their days and lives." Throughout, there are some choice episodes, none weirder than the one in 1973, when the Nolans visit Sydney, intent on monopolising Harrower. Cynthia Nolan takes great exception to Harrower's decision to go off on a cruise and refuses to see her, as Harrower reports to Hazard. "I said, what about relenting for half an hour and we'd talk of non-controversial things? But Cynthia said it would upset her too much, and there we were. I'm sad about it, but she is fragile, and I've seen her ill and down physically and psychically always. She thinks I'm used, apparently, and credits me with a rather frailer and simpler character than I possess." Frail or simple, neither of these writers was. There are some classic letters here that would be worthy of a second edition of the Oxford Book of Australian Letters, should Brendan Isle be persuaded to revisit it. One example is Hazard's gleeful, excoriating letter of the 15th of May 1982, in which he describes a rancorous dinner that Sumner Locke Elliott was forced to endure Shea Patrick White. When Sumner flees, White appears on the veranda and calls out, "Come back!" Sumner does, sensing remorse on White's part, whereupon Patrick yelled, "Not you, the dogs!" Hazard and Harrower teems with gossip, whimsy, illuminations, reassurance, disappointments, and a rather Australian kind of informality and sisterliness, perhaps not something we might have expected from Shirley Hazard.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Book Review podcast. Join us again next week. If you enjoyed this episode, why not consider subscribing to ABR? Subscriptions start from just $10 a month for full digital access. Visit our website for more information. We'd like to thank Stacey Chan, who edits the podcast, as well as our contributors who take the time to read their articles and creative writing. And if you enjoy listening to the ABR podcast, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes.